Yellow Star Thistle. Yellow Star Thistle is a quite old project, started in the 50s when they sort of resolved the issues with the beekeepers in California. The first agent, Urofa Jackalata, failed to establish. All the other agents appeared to be established. But in 1988...
Today I'd like to share with you some of the specific goals, ways, and outcomes of incorporating experiential undergraduate research into my general entomology course at Luther College. And I do this as a way of improving learning for my students. And I want to thank both Tiffany and Marianne for organizing this symposium and kind of letting me get on board, because I think we do it a little bit differently at Luther. And I want to give you a little bit of background just about Luther College, because we are kind of a different kind of institution than I think most of you are familiar with. Luther is a small, nationally ranked, selective liberal arts college, and we have only 2,500 students, and we have no graduate students, no master's students, no PhDs, and teaching undergraduates is our main focus. And although faculty scholarship is very important at Luther College for promotion and tenure, it's not expected at the levels, I would say, of most R1 Logical Foundation undergraduate scholarship. And recently we've had two President's Poster Prize competition runner-up winners, and these are undergrads competing against graduate students. We've also had a number of students who have contributed significantly as co-authors to peer-reviewed publications, such in articles published in entomology and other environmental entomology on projects that they worked with me on. So in conclusion, I'd like to share this comment from another former student. One of the people that I talked to, or most of the people I have talked to about my undergraduate education, have been jealous about the labs, trips, and independent research experiences that I was able to participate in as a student. It seems that most students did not have the flexibility to choose research projects that they were interested in. These experiential learning opportunities, these were his words, not mine, showed me the value of being able to learn new things on my own, and not having to rely on teachers or professors to give me all the information, something we heard about this morning. This is the most important skill for me in graduate school. One of my goals as a teacher is to prepare my students for becoming scientists with the skills to make a difference in the world, no matter what they happen to become later on in life. And I feel providing these experiences should be a goal in all the courses we teach. Thank you. Any questions?
Just a quick question. I'm just curious. I really, it sounds great what you're doing, you know, like accommodations. What other courses that you're, it looks like students are putting a lot of time, a lot of work, a lot of energy. What other courses are requiring this level of research in them?
We have a number of courses that are doing this, both in biology as well as chemistry, psychology, physics. But in biology specifically, I also do this in my invertebrate zoology course. The ecology class does it, the botany class. I think our there's a molecular biology class.
Just a quick follow-up. Is there any signs of students getting burnt out, or does the repeated research experience kind of fuel them? Is it more of a positive feedback or a burnout factor?
I haven't seen students getting burned out by doing these projects. What I see is they get really excited because they're picking a project they want to do, and they really enjoy doing that. And especially when they get to the end and they have, you know, written up this paper and they've presented a poster, they really get a good feeling of satisfaction as if they've done something and contributed something useful. And so to me, it's the students have gotten excited about it, not burned out by it. And I've actually asked students, would you rather do an investigative research project or a series of kind of directed, you know, research projects like the mealworm paper, and they always say they'd rather do the investigative ones. So, last question.
Since you have many students that are pre-med or pre-health professions, have you had any feedback on how they feel this approach helps them on, you know what, the middle MCAT?
Right. I honestly don't think it helps them with scoring on the MCAT, but I definitely know that the medical schools are looking at having research experiences both inside and outside the classroom, as well as graduate schools are looking at that as being extremely important for being able to prepare them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, 8 years later, Baldo and I found that there's actually another fly out there that looks quite similar to the Keterellia australis, the permitted agent. And after checking through our records and stuff, we determined that it actually had been released in Merlin, Oregon in 1991. Both Succinia and australis have very similar life histories. The eggs are laid on the sides of the buds, three instars inside that feed on developing seeds, overwinter as a late instar, and up to three generations a year. Now, the reason that one shipment actually had multiple species was that all the previous release had been done from australis that had been reared from Centuria cyanus, bachelor bud, cornflower, depending what you want to call it. Those cyanus heads had been shipped from Greece, and the flies that emerged from that had been sent to the release points. But in 1991, they wanted to get some extra releases done that year, and cyanus was gone by that time in Greece, so they sent the yellow star heads. And it was from yellow star that two different species of Keterellia emerged. They're pretty similar in appearance. What you want to look at is this extra spot on the side of the thorax. That is Succinia. That's one fast way to distinguish it from the permitted australis. Now, once we got a name for this, it was kind of oops. Succinia had been rejected as a possible agent by our overseas scientists because in their laboratory tests, it would oviposit on safflower. And safflower is a reasonably important crop in California. You know, it's not a major crop, but it's reasonably important. So California Department of Food and Agriculture issued a test alert about Succinia being out there now. And we immediately started testing various varieties of safflower to see if any of these are acceptable. Oops. Now, under no choice conditions, we would get some oviposition on safflower, but under choice conditions, there was no oviposition. So, that's sort of equivocal results. You know, we're saying that, yeah, if they got stuck, yellow star there, and yellow star is acceptable, that they probably go on yellow star and safflower. But the worst case could happen out in the field. So we also grew trap plants of safflower, the five varieties we had at three study sites, two in Oregon near where the Succinia had first been released in '91, and plus in Napa County, California. The safflower in our trap plant studies was surrounded by yellow star thistle, and yellow star thistle had millions of Succinia by that time. We were able to get about 1,000 heads of safflower, the ones that the deer didn't eat, and we dissected these. Well, first we held them for emergence, and then after the flies had finished emerging, we also dissected them, and there was nothing. No flies, no Succinia in those heads. There was other insects that had moved in, some of them known pests of safflower, but no Succinia. So that made us feel a little better that even in these kind of nasty situations where the safflower is surrounded by yellow star thistle, none of it had been attacked. But we also surveyed commercial fields throughout California. And first year, we only looked at five fields, and then we added 43 fields in '98. At one of those fields, in '97, we found that 24 heads out of more than 3,000 actually had been attacked by Succinia. So we went back to that same field in '98, and once again, there was very low level infestation. By '99, this had dropped, to almost very difficult to detect, and we just weren't going to dissect thousands of heads to find that one more fly. And of the 17,000 heads from the other 46 sites, this took a few years to get through all these heads, splitting them and see what's inside. There was nothing, you know. So we concluded that, you know, succinia isn't going to be a real problem to our safflower growers. So the next thing we worried about was, you know, the other plants in the family cardioid. As been mentioned before, this is, you know, yellow star thistle is an asteraceous plant, and it's in the family, the thistle family. And within the thistle family, it's in the subtribe Centaurinae over here. And here's our safflower. And the ones with the rest asterisks are the genera that have species in North America. Now, Sassaria has native species, a few native species. Onoportum is all introduced, exotic. Cerium is perhaps the most important, since there's probably over 100 native species of Cerium in North America. So the next thing we did was to start looking at whether succinia would take our native species of Cerium. So we, in our laboratory test, we tested, you know, four natives plus some of the weedy cardioid. None of the cerciums were attacked, but three centaureas, you know, these knapweeds, were attacked both under choice and no choice conditions. And those three were Centaurea americana, melitensis, and sulphurea. Now, melitensis and sulphurea are introduced weeds. Fairly low level attacks on both of these. Here's the number of heads. And americana, three out of five tests, there was attack under choice conditions even. So we started monitoring plants in the field to see if they'd validate our laboratory tests. 110 collections from 31 counties in California, Oregon, and 84 collections of 19 species of Cerium, 36 collections of Centaurea species. No succinia in any of the Cerium. So at least none of the native Cerium or introduced Cerium are going to be hosts. But we did confirm that both those, the melitensis and sulphurea, were good field hosts. Melitensis especially was much better field host than our laboratory test would have indicated. It was almost as good as yellow star thistle. And that concerned me because melitensis has a better distribution through the Southwest than yellow star thistle. Now, I mentioned that we have attack also on basket flower. Centaurea americana back in the old days, it looks like it's going to be called Plectocephalus americanus from now on. But this is what the one of the two native Centaureas. Now they're both going to be Plectocephalus. And yeah, they're attractive knapweeds. They're grown as a ornamental backyard plant. Americana occurs in this sort of nice string through the Southwest and the prairie states here. Rothrockii is actually not quite as widely distributed as this map would look like. It's only in the southernmost counties, a few of the southernmost counties in New Mexico and Arizona. So it's a Mexican species that barely enters the United States. So we were unable to do field surveys of succinia attacking americana because americana doesn't occur in California and succinia doesn't occur where americana grows, at least not yet. So we set up last year trap plant studies in three sites in California. Let me just back up on that. One was almost in Oregon, up in Yreka. Yountville is in Napa County, a sort of coastal site, and then the Central Valley site at CDFA facility in your Sacramento. So once again, you know, Americana, and then what we call now Americana's B, it was sold, the seeds were sold to us as Rothrockii, but after they flowered, we found out, no, they're not Rothrockii, they're actually just a different variety of Americanus. So we ended up with two varieties of Americanus instead of Americanus and Rothrockii. But both varieties were susceptible to attack. The attack was generally no higher than 10%. And this was at all three sites that happened. And one thing to note is the high level of attack, like this is from our Sacramento site, you know, over 80% of the star thistle heads are being attacked compared to the 10% attack on Americanus. Now pooling all the seed data across the three sites, we find that about there's maybe a 40% reduction of seeds in the heads that are attacked. Now only 10% of the heads at most are attacked, and if the head is attacked, it'll have 40% less seeds than if it hadn't been attacked. So what we have ended up now is that we've got a very widely distributed natural enemy. In a 2002 survey, only one site out of 421 did not have succinia. So yellow star and succinia are co-occur throughout California. It's nearly impossible to find yellow star without succinia. It's also very damaging to yellow star thistle. We are all noting that yellow star thistle is kind of responding to this sustained attack by succinia, and it's probably our best agent. You know, even though it's not a real agent. So, you know, Link asked me to sort of conclude with, you know, what we learned. Well, this best agent that we have out there for California, at least, was rejected, you know, back in the early 80s. You know, so that kind of makes me think, at least, you know, that we need to be more careful, perhaps, in rejecting agents. That if we reject our best agents early on and then just keep introducing, you know, poor agents, that we may miss out. And of course, obviously, several agents can come in the same shipment, and you know, we need to be careful about that. During the release phase, you know, sort of the standard operating procedure of releasing, you know, insects reared from heads collected overseas, that's dangerous. And this is a case study what can happen, you know, so a second insect can get released. Also, you can release the parasitoids of your agent, diseases of your agent. So, you know, unless there's really a supreme reason that you need to do those releases with insects from overseas, you should at least go through one generation in the lab. Of course, human errors can occur. My predecessors were aware of succinia's existence, and they were supposedly checking these shipments, but that one shipment, those flies did get through. Now, the other thing sort of concerned me is that very few of these weedy centaurea species were tested to see if Keterellia australis accept them. You know, they knew, since Cyanus was the host they were collecting it from, that Cyanus was a good host, but they didn't test, you know, Melitensis and these other ones. And, you know, the usual excuse is, well, if they attack these other weeds, great, you know, just bonus. But it doesn't give us a good prediction on what species will find them. And more importantly, since Melitensis extends a geographical range of succinia well beyond that of yellow star thistle, it can, you know, bring in contact now to Centaurea americana, which based on yellow star thistle's distribution would be less likely. So, you know, this attack on Plectocephalus Centaurea americana is now more likely because Melitensis is a host. Well, during the post-release phase, something we learned was, you know, if you screw up, let people know. don't try to hide it. We did get complimented for, you know, immediately notifying our cooperators, you know, about this, you know, error. And I guess, and personally, along with sort of my colleagues' rather, you know, attack on Svachalauta when she let them know about, you know, these non-target impacts of Rhinocyhylus, you know, it just made me think that, you know, biocontrol needs some self-regulation. It needs some guidelines. There's thousands of people now involved, you know, especially out west here where there's people at county levels making decisions what agents to release and what targets to choose and stuff like that. So, you know, they're not under the control. When I started in biocontrol, there was like half a dozen of us. We all knew each other. You know, we knew who would do it, make a mistake and stuff like that. So now that's way too big. And so I guess the other good thing that came out is that there was an international code of best practices for biological control of weeds. Some of these, you know, guidelines would help prevent something like succinia from occurring. So this code was ratified in 1999 by delegates to the 10th Symposium Biological Control of Weeds. And, you know, it seems to be having some impacts on people, making them think of how they're doing the practice of biocontrol. So there was some of the things I learned by working on succinia. Thank you. Well, exactly. I reserve the term agent for something that's gone through the TAG approval process, APHIS approval process. A natural enemy, you know, that there's a natural enemy and then there's agents. So there's many natural enemies. Some are adventive, some are native, you know, but introduced agents, when I use the term agent, it means it's gone through the approval process.
But it's not like that.
We're unsure how broad the range of succinia is. Our Greek cooperators were unaware that it occurred at their sites. So I've been unable to find the tephritids that these guys collected there. I could find the curculionids and stuff in their collections. I was trying to reconstruct that, you know, where is it? You know, what did they know? So, another question? Dave Thompson has been sending me some Americana heads from New Mexico, and we've been, you know, trying to see if they've got succinia in them, and they're remarkably clean from anything. You know, unlike our cerciums that we always sort of got, you know, native tephritids and stuff out of. So does that kind of answer your question?
So what are the interactions between the two blind species that the one was initially introduced? Has their population gone down?
No, Keterelia australis seems to be restricted almost to cyanus. That we do find it on yellow star thistle, but usually only if cyanus is present nearby. So its range, geographical range, is much more limited than succinia's, because cyanus tends to be a cooler weather, moister, you know, so it's kind of either higher elevations or more coastal. And, you know, of course, yellow star thistle grows in the arid, you know, central valley and stuff. So it's still out there, and it looks like australis may be actually helping control cyanus. But as an agent for yellow star thistle, it's next to worthless.
Developed out of a project that Rose DeClercq Float and Harriet Hintz did largely while Rose was on sabbatical in Australia a couple of years ago, I think. And they surveyed a lot of weed biocontrol practitioners to see whether insect rearing problems and techniques had been kind of a limiting factor in some of their projects. And they gathered a lot of information on what kind of insect rearing problems people had encountered and what effect that had on the outcomes of biocontrol projects. And they presented this, and there was a discussion at the International Symposium in Montpellier earlier this year. And the consensus was that a lot of this information at the sort of level of problems and tips and techniques and tricks and so on never makes it out into the literature, but that there's a lot of collective wisdom that could be used to help people solve their insect rearing problems. So at that session, I volunteered to set up kind of a clearinghouse where people could share these kinds of problems and techniques and solutions. So it's now up and running. To get to it, the easiest way is to go to my website, MacLeod Ecoscience. You'll see a link that says Resources. If you click on that, you'll see a link that says Weed Biocontrol Forum. And once you get in there, there are instructions for how to use it. Anybody can read what's been posted on the forum, but in order to actually contribute and post questions and replies, you have to register. This is to keep the spammers out, which would otherwise totally overwhelm it. To register, again, to keep the spammers out, you have to answer an extremely easy question about weed biocontrol. And the answer is Cactoblastis, if you don't know. and then once you've registered, you can contribute your own questions and responses and so on to that forum. Quite a few people have registered so far, but the actual amount of contributions have been fairly low. So please, if you're interested, if you think it would be useful, take a look and sign up. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for accepting me after an unannounced email, because this is my first time to the US and my first time at the NSOC America meeting. So I was thinking just giving one 10-minute seminar, it's a long way to come for just 10 minutes of chatting. So I thought at least I'd try and fit my way somehow into one of the other talks. And also, as the talks went on during the morning, I was getting more and more overwhelmed at the quality, and especially from the last talk, I was feeling completely overwhelmed about how to continue on sort of talking about entomology teaching and the importance of contributing knowledge to students. And I guess being a relatively young lecturer, I've only been an academic for 3 years, and through my undergraduate career, seeing the changes from the overhead use from the slides to the PowerPoints that all the time broke down, and then finally to sort of PowerPoints now, which are hopefully reasonably sort of consistent in their usage. And I'm probably going to be doing one of the most terrible things possible, is actually going between technologies, so using PowerPoint and then showing you my modularized degree on the web. So hopefully all goes well. So one of the reasons I have modularized a talk is A, because I got some funding to do so, and also as a undergraduate and also through my PhD, one of the ways that information that was always given to me was by lectures, and also given an exam at the end. And time after time when I was doing my exams, I usually went really well throughout the semester, but when it came to the exams, I never took a lot of information in during lectures. I was one of those terrible students that glazed over about 3 minutes into the lecture, and I couldn't understand why, what was going on, and why I couldn't keep the information in my head at the end of for the final exam, which was usually worth 70 or 80%. And as I started to be an academic, one of the prerequisites that we have at UNE is to do a graduate certificate in higher education. So it's mandatory to do it, actually get a professional certificate to become a teacher at the higher education level. I was basically dropped into it by one of the professors at Macquarie, Professor Andy Beattie, where he originally gave me the opportunity to give a tutorial. Then the next year he said to me, okay, why don't you just run my unit? And it worked. I mean, it was basically a sink or swim mentality, and that's how a lot of people do get into teaching. And we hopefully, it was great to actually do this graduate certificate. It had its pros and cons in the fact that it took a lot of time away from my research, which it's taking a long time to get up and running, but it gave me the opportunity to actually learn how to teach and learn how to teach effectively. So what I'll do is go through why changing, also the old entomology curriculum that the Mary Notestein, who was originally, I think she was from Iowa, I think she came over from the US in the early 80s, I think, to UNE. What she had in her curriculum and what I've been teaching for the last 2 years, the new curriculum, and then hopefully a bit of time to check out the website. So again, the way that I've always been thinking is our lectures the best way to disseminate entomological information to students. And especially in these days where, as we've seen in the previous talk, there are excellent textbooks out there. In particular, for me, I use Gullen and Cranston for parochial reasons, because they are originally from Australia. And also, there's lots of interesting Australian examples in there as well. Plus, also, there are some good field guides that are relatively cheap. So you can have the theory-based book and then a good field guide to help the students actually understand the taxa that they're using. And a whole range of information on the internet. Obviously, a lot of it comes from the US and also from Europe. But these days, students are actually getting more up-to-date information in a lot of ways than I am. They're on the internet Googling more, using the information sources out there to get information relatively quickly. Whether that information is good or bad, that's a different story, but there is information out there which they have to synthesise anyway. And also, what we don't have at UNE and also at many other institutions in Australia is entire degrees in entomology anymore. It's basically been whittled away, so there's majors in some universities if you're lucky. At Armidale, I'm lucky to have an entomology unit at all. Most universities have lost their entomology units and they've been sort of subsumed into invertebrate zoology. So I was really surprised, A, that when I was accepted as a lecturer in entomology in the first place. And also, how do I teach a second year entomology degree and encompass so much information that's out there? What can I do to not include everything, but to give the students a good idea about some of the many aspects of entomology that they might be they might see or they might come across in their day-to-day lives, as well as in their future professions. So one of the reasons why I have decided to change to a modularised curriculum is to make it more an authentic learning experience, rather than, obviously, once they leave undergraduates, they never do a lecture. They very rarely go to a lecture anymore. They go to hear an expert in the field or someone very much more charismatic than I am in teaching. They might want to hear one or two a year. Who wants to go to a lecture 12 or 13 or 14 lectures every week and try and synthesise that amount of information and come out feeling excited about the curriculum? It's very difficult, and it's good for the top students, but for the bulk of students that I come across, again, that glazed look the first couple of weeks is fantastic, but 5 minutes into the lecture you just see the eyeballs go back into the head and you're just talking to blank faces. And it can be, obviously, if you're just doing a classic style of lecture, it's very difficult to get their retain their sort of interest in the topic over a sustained period over a semester. Also, to make it more flexible and self-directed, at UNE we're unusual in the sense that two-thirds of the students are actually off campus. We only get to see the students for 4 days every semester. So a lot of the time they're external students. They might be in Sydney or might be in other parts of Australia, even some from overseas. So you actually might only get to see the students very rarely. So you actually have to be very flexible in the way you deliver. Previously, it's just been handing out a 200-page lectures, just lectures basically in a page format. That's been the standard for the last 30 or 40 years at UNE to deliver information to off-campus students. And so again, making it more flexible so they can actually work at their own pace, but also make it more interactive with both me and the other students in previously they've had no sort of interaction with. And also make the curriculum more responsive to changes. A lot of people who, especially in Australia, don't call themselves entomologists anymore. They're ecologists, they're biochemists, they work in a whole range of industries. And in a lot of cases, the entomology as a name has sort of whittled away in some sense. So it's actually bringing all those people together who work on insects or work on their physiology, their behaviour, or work in an ecological sense, and say they've all got these components of entomology embedded within them, and also how they're related to other fields. Try and give the students an idea about what's going on, how entomology is related to the wider world. One of the other really interesting things I came across when I was actually doing literature reviews for the graduate certificate was the NSF have learning strategies, which I found really exciting. I think this was from the early 2000s, but actually to see a government agency, a research agency, actually coming up with ideas about how sort of teaching and learning should be embedded with research. And there was a great sort of quote here about giving other alternatives to model the methods and mindsets at the heart of scientific inquiry, actually making students excited about teaching. We saw a lot of examples today about how individuals can make a big difference to their students, but in a way it's actually getting the entire discipline, the entire field up to that point as well. How can every sort of academic or every teacher make it enthusiastic for students? Again, it's one of the issues I come across is that people who are academics, who are professors, the last thing they want to do is teach. They're there for the research, but they're still going to spend 40% of their time teaching, and they hate it, and the students know that. And they basically don't want to go to their classes, but they have to in order to pass the unit. And I think that's really sad that if you spend 40% of your time teaching, that you're actually hating what you do. And also connecting abstract ideas to real-world applications while getting useful skills. So understanding, you know, how to make connections, but also embedding in that skills that students can use in any sort of area that they might get a job in. Not only just as a postgraduate, going into a PhD, going into a postdoc. So essentially what modularisation is redefining the units of study. It's essentially making the modules a standalone entity. So if, you know, theoretically you could actually come in and take any one of the modules and still be able to learn something from it. Obviously it's good to do the first module first and then go through them in a sequence, but essentially they can be done, they're sort of a standalone entity in many ways. There are content boundaries, so that there are individual assessments to do with each module, and obviously each module has a separate learning outcome and assessment items. And as well, there's formal and informal assessments and prerequisites necessary to complete that particular module. So the students know that what's due in a few weeks' time. Once they've done that, it's finished, then they can go on to the next step. So the old unit structure is very much a classic, well, it's a classic method in Australia. It will, over time, the number of lectures that we give has been whittled away in a 13, well, it used to be a 13-week semester, and I think now it's getting down to 11 weeks. And essentially, it was based on a few weeks of diversity lectures, so going through the major orders, some of the families, morphology, and then a few weeks on applied themes. 10 practicals, just to go, again, following the order of the lectures. A final exam, which was worth 60%. The ubiquitous insect collection. And also a scientific report, which was based on 3 weeks of the prac period, where they actually go out, collect their own sort of insects. They usually put comparing two different habitats. So they do some sort of